From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and this is a show where every week we deal with mental health issues. I take a more holistic perspective, which means finding a balance in our lives of body, mind, and spirit. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free. The question we ask on this show is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? How long are you willing to stay stuck in your patterns, your denials, your fears, your all the things, your belief systems, and all the negativity that we've created and amassed over our lifetime that weigh us down and keep us stuck and keep us stuck in fear instead of feeling the freedom that healing and forgiveness and a heart space and love can really bring to us. Now, we deal with, like I said, mental health issues, behavioral issues every week on the show. And this is Saturday afternoon, is trauma and addictions. And this is a live call-in show. If you're driving around and you're on your cell phone, be careful as you're making the call, or if you're at home or in an office. The number in Phoenix is 480, area code 949-1310. That's 480-949-1310, as in KXAM 1310 AM. And if you're listening via the Internet, since this is simulcast live over the Internet, and I know I do have callers as far away as New York and Vancouver and L.A. and all around the country, it's the same toll number, unfortunately, is 480-949-1310, but it's not that expensive a call, so call in and participate. If you have a question or comments about today's topic or anything else dealing relevantly with mental health issues. Now, when I talk about trauma and addictions, as a therapist, I've been doing addictions counseling for, I guess, all my career. My first job, after graduate school, I was hired as a night watchman in West Palm Beach, Florida, at a long-term residential drug abuse treatment program that dealt with everything from adolescents to adults in their 50s. And my job initially for the first month was to actually stay up all night, and every 15 to 20 minutes I had to make the rounds and count the heads in the beds, so to speak, to make sure nobody's run away, because it wasn't a lockdown facility. And 3-4 weeks later, I was offered a counseling position. And 3 years later, I was actually executive director of the agency. So my background in addictions counseling goes way back. And actually, it goes back to a time in the early 70s. It was 1974, mid-70s, when 12-step programs certainly were around, because they'd been around for decades up to that point, but within the treatment community, they weren't necessarily the approach that was favored. There was hardcore synonym type of stuff, which actually this program did some of, you know, people wearing signs and scrubbing the pool area with a toothbrush, you know, all these types of what I consider traumatic and abusive types of approaches, although in some cases they actually made somebody a bit more conscious, but to me not necessarily the most therapeutic approach. Now, being the only staff member at that program with a master's degree and some training, and yet not a recovering addict myself, I was kind of in a minority. But a lot of the other staff seemed to appreciate some of the tools and techniques that I was bringing to kind of counterbalance some of their approaches. And over the years, I've noticed that 12-step programs had a real sense of suspicion about therapy. But, you know, of course, therapists back then were really kind of abusive to people who were dealing with alcoholism or drug abuse. And it's taken decades for things to get where they are today, where there is actually, even within the 12-step community as well as in the therapy community, a complementary relationship for the most part, where a lot of people in 12-step recovery are also seeing therapists. A lot of therapists really insist that their clients go to 12-step programs. There's a real understanding of the complementary relationship that exists. And it's with that tone and that approach that today's conversation on trauma and addictions comes into play. Now, all of us can relate to trauma, but not all of us can relate to addiction. So if you think back in your own life, and remember, trauma is relative to your own personal experience. To somebody who has been sexually abused and molested and raped, or, you know, the victim of gun battles in the streets or invasions in the homes, to them, that's trauma, and that's a major thing. To some of us, trauma may consist of a verbally aggressive or abusive mother or father, or an absent mother or father. And remember that one is no greater or lesser. It's not about judging whose trauma was worse than the others, because it's relative. Trauma is trauma, and it leaves its imprint on all of us in various ways. Some of us are able to integrate it and move beyond it, and it doesn't necessarily have a major impact on our lives. But for most people are in therapy because, and they may not realize it when they go seeking a therapist, but because there are certain belief systems and behavior patterns that got imprinted as a result of certain traumas in our childhood or even earlier adulthood. So whether we're dealing with post-traumatic stress syndrome, which we'll describe a little bit later, whether we're dealing with being victimized through sexual abuse, rape, or other type of violent, or more covert and subtle types of things that have happened, those traumas need to be identified, and the denial around it needs to be broken, and the little kid inside of us that's still in terror of those experiences needs to be comforted and nurtured and told that there is somebody caring enough about him or her to kind of come out of the hiding and out of the darkness and know that there is an adult in their lives now learning how to take better care of him or her. So trauma very often gets masked and covered by compulsive behaviors and addictions, whether it's alcohol, whether it's drugs, whether it's sex, whether it's spending money, whether it's eating, no matter what. Very often you're going to find people in an addictive process that the very thing that they're hiding the most from is some kind of trauma early on. And it's being in the safe environment of a therapist or a treatment program, or a family that's beginning to wake up and work on it together, that really is the total picture of the healing process. Those are the issues we're going to be dealing with today. And my guest today is very well versed in these areas. Her name is Adina Bank-Lees. She's a certified clinical social worker, an internationally certified addictions counselor, a board-certified expert in traumatic stress, and a certified Imago relationship therapist. Now, Imago therapy, if you listen a couple of weeks ago, I had Joe Cord on, who's also a certified Imago relationship therapist. We talked about that for a bit. So you're going to be hearing that word a lot more because I think it's an approach to couples counseling and relationship counseling that's beginning to really grow. She's also on staff at Sierra Tucson Treatment Center near Tucson, and we're going to talk a bit about Sierra Tucson's program today also. Adina, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Stuart. Glad to be here.
And I kind of did a wide-range introduction there, but I was trying to kind of set a stage here. But I really want to leave it up to you to define more specifically what we mean by trauma. I know I gave examples, but I didn't necessarily give a definition of what trauma is. So what is trauma? How do you define it?
Well, there are a couple of pieces. One, first I want to say to you that everything you said in your intro is absolutely how I view the development of addictions, and I want to talk more about that, as well as the recovery from addictions and the combination of trauma and how Sierra Tucson deals with it. First, the definition of trauma. There are a couple of ones that I use. The one that Sierra Tucson uses is that trauma is a perceived, underlined neon perceived, threat to your own or somebody else's life, safety, and security. So again, what you had said about perception and not comparing my trauma to yours. Yours is worse than mine, so I shouldn't have any feelings, and yours is bigger, and so you deserve it, but I don't. You know, that's not, no. The other piece.
Are you there, Gina?
I heard some noise.
Okay, no, we're still on. Go ahead.
Okay. So the perception of the person about threat to their own life, safety, or security. And something that's really important to point out is from a very, very young person's perspective, and I want to go even to infancy, that an infant can perceive threat to life by not being attended to when they cry,
mm-hmm.
By not getting enough food, by not getting held and mirrored. And this stuff is not in our thinking brain that we would have memories of it and pictures of it and words for it. Absolutely, the research is showing that we have cellular and neurological memory for neglect, for abuse, if you want to say, for needs not getting met.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the word abuse and trauma are real big, and I know that some people, and I've worked with a lot of clients, who say, you know, no, you're stretching out the definition of trauma way too much, and some professionals I've spoken to as well. And so the most important thing is that we absolutely are, like you said earlier, we are very much impacted on a cellular level, a very primitive level in our brain development from early on, when needs are not met.
Mm-hmm.
And we describe those as traumas.
Right.
And the way that they impact the development of the brain, the development of our belief system, the development of our attitudes and behaviors and our coping mechanisms is really key, and I think you hit a lot of it on the head when you were talking.
Well, it's interesting to me because I don't hear, to be honest with you, I loved what you just said about how far back this goes, even to infancy, because I know you looked at my website and stuff, and you know that one of the things I do is rebirthing, which is a form of breathing that actually helps access a lot of that cellular memory for the purpose of healing and releasing and moving it through in a very simple yet profound way. And for years, the breath work that I've done with clients and my own has clearly demonstrated memory that's in there that relates to that infant's sense of abandonment or not, you know, crying and nobody comes.
Absolutely.
Or being held in a way that wasn't safe. And even through the birth process itself, you know, traumas that occur there and the importance of healing, it even going back that far.
And I want to add into there intrauterine.
Mm-hmm.
And I've worked with clients who absolutely knew
that they were
either, quote-unquote, a mistake.
Very, yes. I'm so glad to be talking to a therapist that, because these are things that as rebirthers we deal with all the time, and it's so refreshing. I don't know if you've done any rebirthing before or know what it is, but it's exactly the approach that I've been taking for years because of the breath work.
Yeah, the way that I know about rebirthing, which is I don't know if it's exactly what you do, because I think people have different ways to do this, possibly what they call the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I absolutely have been a part of Stan Grof
holotropic
breath work and mm-hmm. Jacqueline Small's integrative breath work that came from Stan Grof. So in that way, I've gotten some education, but actual formal rebirthing, the way you do it, I may not be familiar with.
It's very similar.
Okay.
Stanislav Grof and Leonard Orr, and it all comes from the same basis and foundation, and then just took a few variations and added different dynamics. But you definitely know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
So in terms of defining the trauma, which you've done, how does trauma, and I know I spoke a little bit about it, the connection between trauma and addictions, how does that perception go in terms of your own work?
I absolutely want to answer that. I want to just add a little bit to the trauma definition, if I may.
Oh, sure.
Okay. One of the things that I teach is not only that the definition I just gave you, but the definition of psychic trauma, which I got from Strauss. And what she says is that it's an experience of helplessness, vulnerability, loss of safety, and control that occurs from an overwhelming, uncontrollable event or series of events.
Say that again.
Yep. The experience of helplessness, vulnerability, loss of safety, and control that occurs from an overwhelming, uncontrollable event or series of events. So again, this is about perceived. So it's in the DSM-4, if anybody knows about that, that's our quote-unquote psychiatric Bible. And where it came in 1976 with the Vietnam vets. Post-traumatic stress disorder was added to the DSM-3 at that time, I believe. And you know, this has been happening. You know this. I'm really saying this for our audience. That this post-traumatic stress disorder or reaction or symptoms, you know, are documented way, 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 way back. And shell shock in World War I, Pierre Janet and Charcot talked about this in the 1800s. They talked about dissociation, which is the splitting off of or compartmentalizing of parts of ourselves or feelings. And Freud was in there as well. With these guys, and then he shifted some. And I find it really interesting, this is just a political kind of bias or side note for me, that when Freud abandoned that idea that the hysterical symptoms that he was seeing in the female clients with blindness and paralysis that had no medical basis, the first theory was that this was about abuse that was happening to them, that they had developed these coping mechanisms in order to keep the trauma and keep the abuse a secret, most of it being sexual abuse, physical sexual abuse, or incest by their fathers. And my understanding is that he shifted that to his Oedipal theory of psychosexual development, saying that these women were really fantasizing about this or dreaming about it. It didn't really happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what we know is that Freud, he was a very smart guy and clever guy, and most of the women patients he was seeing were daughters of his medical colleagues in Vienna. And he also wanted to get known. And so if he would have stayed with that theory, how well known would he have been?
So politics came into play in terms of psychological theory, so he changed tacks as a way of protecting his territory.
Absolutely. I mean, that's my bias. That's what I've learned.
Well,
and
happens,
you know,
all the time, unfortunately. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, we can't, with therapy, we are dealing with politics as well, and, you know, what's in and accepted and what's not accepted. So with this whole thing about trauma, to go back, is, you know, we know that trauma has impacted us for, you know, centuries, and we are just really beginning to have the technology and I think the awareness and consciousness to appreciate and to be specific about how does it impact. And with the explosion of things like SPECT scans and PET scans that are really helping us, people like Bruce Perry, who is one of my favorite researchers, he's showing us that absolutely we have this thing called cellular memory that's not in a picture or words. And one of the things that Perry talks about is there was a boy who was beaten so badly by his dad that he was unconscious and had severe brain damage, and he was not able to speak any longer. And it damaged that part of his brain. And one of the things that they did in the hospital was they played a tape of Dad's voice And what they did was they measured his heart rate, his blood pressure, which would be his, I think it's autonomic nervous system or parasympathetic, whatever, but it's the fight or flight piece.
Right, yeah, his panic reaction.
Yeah, his panic reaction, and everything went skyrocketing. So his body knew. That was the trigger. Dad's voice was a trigger. For some kids, it was a cologne or a smell.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't able, you know, and even with infants, they're doing that, and they're seeing the blood pressure going up. And sometimes it goes totally down, and kids will faint. They'll pass out. And so with these extreme reactions from the central nervous system, they're showing that you don't have to you don't have to be thinking about it or seeing a picture in order for it to be traumatizing to you. Is that clear?
It is to me, and you actually explain it very succinctly and very clearly, and you're using very good examples. So I think even the layperson listening can really relate to it. And there are people listening who are hearing that, and I'm sure their cellular memory is being triggered right now. Just if someone out there is feeling your heart beating a little faster, or you're sweating, or you're beginning to find a sense of panic going on because of what Adine is saying, be aware that you may be dealing with some memory coming up, so just keep breathing and
exactly. Deep breath, deep.
Yes, deep
yeah.
breaths and
feet on the ground.
Yes, and pull over if you're driving. So
absolutely, absolutely. So this feeling of helplessness and vulnerability is very, very common in people who have been traumatized. And one thing I want to throw in that that I have been working with and dealing with a loved one for the last several months has been adoption. And if we want to talk cellular memory and abandonment, so this is something that we really, and I want to put out there for the lay people, but also any professionals that are listening, to put out there that to ask about if someone, you know, was with their natural parents, biological parents or not, and if they were adopted, to start asking questions about that, because that absolutely can be a traumatic experience cellularly, and we see it a lot of times in terms of coming into adolescence with identity,
right,
which makes a lot of sense. And there can be very much more than that in terms of the abandonment. It can show up in our behaviors,
mm-hmm.
and that's what you were asking me about. How does trauma relate to addictions? And I think you explained really nicely in the beginning. You set it up nicely for me. And one of the things that I teach about is that when there is perceived trauma, when I have felt helpless, vulnerable, unsafe, and out of control, that there's a part of my brain that registers that. And that part is called the amygdala. And that part of the brain does not have any words, and it doesn't have any pictures. And so what ends up happening is my brain starts developing literally differently, different kinds of connections, different senses are heightened, and this stuff starts showing up in the way that I believe, my attitudes, and my behaviors. And so there is so much shame along with the fear, which is inherent in feeling unsafe and out of control, the terror, actually, because if you think about, you know, in utero, an infant, a toddler, you know, up until 9 or 10 years old, totally dependent on adults for their life.
Mm-hmm.
And so the terror that's there, that is a threat to their life, and doesn't have to be a gun to somebody's head.
Mm-hmm.
And so our brain reacts to that, and there's another chemical called cortisol, which will bathe your brain, and that's a stress hormone. And we're seeing that that hormone absolutely impacts memory and can lead to amnesia about things. And so people who say, you know, I really don't remember anything before 12 or before 7, it's not okay, you know, for us to say, oh, well, then you probably had trauma in your history. I mean, that's a pretty leading statement. I wouldn't say that.
Right.
And at the same time, for the people who experience that, to have some information that there may have been high stress in your life where there were high levels of this thing called cortisol and other chemicals that impacted your brain and that you don't have clear memory of.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense. So this is, I'm just kind of giving you general pieces about trauma and how it impacts people.
I think all of that is important. I think one of the other things that I find that sometimes therapists jump to conclusions too fast that someone has been traumatized personally is that that child may be growing up in a household where mom or dad may have experienced the trauma,
mm-hmm.
and they are picking up the subtle reactions of mom or dad in terms of their own panic and their own reactions to things, so that it's almost a learned behavior because you're picking it up based on mom and dad's childhood experience or adult experience, and it's almost like a loyalty behavior.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. So,
you're absolutely right.
Not to jump to conclusions too fast without getting more of a background in history. It may not be that the person's in denial themselves or blocking it themselves. It may be mom or dad's trauma that they are playing out the next generation of reaction.
Exactly. And what I usually teach people is that the most powerful forms of learning are modeling and experience. And we know about, you know, so what am I being modeled and what is my experience? And we know that kids are extreme sponges for feelings and without any words. And they know all the secrets in the family. They know all the stuff.
Right.
And how do they show it? By their behavior.
Exactly.
And so,
Dina, we're gonna take a short break here.
Okay.
To kind of regroup. And when we come back, I'd like to shift gears and start talking more about the treatment aspect of this.
You got it.
And so if you're listening in and you want to call in, remember, you're listening to Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM in Phoenix, and the call-in number is 480-949-1310 or 1310. And we're going to take a short break here. This is Stuart Altschuler on Tell the Truth Faster with Adina Bank-Lees, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes, so stay tuned. Welcome back to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altschuler. You're listening to KXAN in Phoenix, and our topic today is trauma and addiction. My guest today is a clinical social worker named Adina Bank-Lees, who specializes in trauma and addiction work, as well as her, and is on staff at Sierra Tucson Treatment Center near Tucson. And we've been talking about what trauma is and how it relates to addictions and how it's defined and all the various places we go looking for it as therapists. And there is a little caveat that we need to really address, and that is the connection between addiction and trauma, and one misperception I think that is almost mythical. So, Adina, can you talk about this myth of addiction and trauma?
Absolutely. One of the myths is, well, if I'm addicted to alcohol, and I'm, you know, and I have this trauma, that I will just go and find out what the trauma is. I'll have somebody, you know, help me remember, and then I'll do therapy on that, and then I won't be addicted anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some therapists who believe the same, is that, you know, if somebody's using, then all we need to do is the feelings work, and then they won't need to do a 12-step program or work specifically on their addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And that is absolutely a myth. That doesn't work. That's not how it goes. Even though we've been speaking about how trauma, a lot of times, perceived trauma, remember, is kind of at the core of the beginning,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, leads into using addiction, compulsive and addictive behaviors in order to survive. And that's my model is, you know, we develop incredible survival skills,
mm-hmm.
addictions being survival skills,
right.
things, and, you know, codependency, if you want to use that word, things like caretaking and enabling and fixing and that, all that stuff are survival skills, and people really have a right to thrive and replace their survival skills with thriving skills. And that's
mm-hmm.
where the treatment piece comes in that you wanted to talk about.
Right. But I need to add to what you're saying also,
sure.
because I think it is so, what you just said is so important. It really needs to be reemphasized, because dealing with the trauma and the hidden emotional things that are going on inside of an addict, that part of the process, I think, if it's done and done in a very deep and real level, helps the recovery program via 12 steps because it, in a way, starts freeing up some of the demons. You know, but the name of the show is Tell the Truth Faster. 12-step
right.
programs would say you're only as sick as your secrets.
That's right.
You know, it's that sort of thing. And so when you this is where the complementary relationship between
exactly.
therapy and 12-step programs works so beautifully, because once the terror is dealt with, it's less threatening to stop using. It's the same thing I've always said with, you know, there are so many people in recovery programs that keep relapsing because they just can't seem to do the assignments and follow up on things the way other people do. And I was an adult diagnosed 9 years with ADD, and what I came to realize is there's a certain percentage of those constantly relapsing people that are undiagnosed and untreated ADD. When you treat that and you have an understanding of that concept, you can adapt the 12-step programs to a method that is more compatible with someone with ADD.
Absolutely. You are right on. You are totally right on. And that's one of the things we see, and we had talked about saying some stuff about Sierra Tucson. And one of the things that we very much believe at Sierra Tucson, one of the reasons I work there is because of their belief that we need to be working on the first layer, which is, you know, stop using the substance or behavior. Get abstinent from that. And what that does is when somebody stops their using, stops their compulsive spending or gambling, stops their starving and begins to eat a regular food plan,
mm-hmm.
stops drinking, feelings start showing up.
Right.
And a lot, oftentimes, you know, if memories are repressed, if you want to even use that word, I call, you know, dissociated or amnestic, amnesia. If that's the case, then when people start getting abstinent, they start, these things start surfacing. And it is critical for relapse issues for people to come and get help. The steps are fabulous, and the steps will not give the recovering person enough support and enough of the technique or methods to be able to deal with that kind of stuff, with the memories and the intense feelings like that, in a way that can be most healing. That is a bias and an opinion of mine. And I also am working, I work three different 12-step programs, so I know them well. I've been doing them for 20 years. And the, you know, the steps have saved my life, and they're incredible tools. And the complement of, I really like what you said about the complement of,
mm-hmm.
And to have therapy be a complement and not in a fight with or a power struggle
right.
with a 12-step program.
Which is the
is
way
the
it used to
best.
Be, and there are still some 12-steppers and some therapists that really,
yeah.
I mean, I know people who have sponsors who really undermine their therapy and their recovery because of their rigid opinions on it.
Well, that's a whole thing. You know, I was at a meeting yesterday, and we were talking about that, about how it's so important for a sponsor. And GSO in New York has pamphlets about sponsorship and about guidelines for sponsorship, and either people don't know or they don't read them. And, you know, to remember that addicts, one of the things about addicts is that we have some big egos, and we're self-centered, and so we get into the sponsor role, and some of us can go a little, you know, a little bit array with that power and start
mm-hmm.
telling people what to do.
Yeah.
And that's what's scary. It's like when I talk to people about being a sponsor, when I am a sponsor, it is, I'm a guide through the 12 steps, and I've worked all the 12 steps, and I live a sober life, and my job is to teach you the big book and the step book and to guide you through the steps.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of it, any decisions are between you and your higher power, and that's in a third and 11th step.
Right.
And sometimes
that higher power is telling you to seek therapy
exactly.
or a treatment program, and sometimes even psychopharmacology is a part of it, and that doesn't mean, if it's used appropriately, it doesn't mean you're relapsing.
Exactly, and that's a big fear in the 12-step community, specifically in AA. I don't know so much about NA, I'll be honest with you, but I know in AA that is a really that people have a lot of opinions about that. And so I just, anybody who's listening, if that's an issue for you, it is really, really important that that you get professional opinion and that it's between you and your higher power. Am I, you know, and to find out, are these chemicals mood-altering or not? Because most of the antidepressants that are given, that, you know, how many millions of people in the United States are on at this point,
mm-hmm.
they are not mood-altering.
Right.
And so there's a lot of misconception out there, and I just really encourage people to get information that's reliable.
Right.
And that, I think that's the most important thing, and to do what's right for you, not what you hear 35 other people in a meeting saying necessarily. It's a tough balance because,
right.
you know, my best thinking got me into 12-step program, and at the same
right.
time, I need to take direction, and at the same time, I also need to check, and again, that's an 11-step practice between me and my higher power. What's my truth?
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So let's get back to Sierra Tucson and to actually your own work, too, because I want to make sure, because I know you actually do a lot of public speaking and workshops, but let's talk first about Sierra Tucson, and then we'll talk more specifically about what you are doing in the community specifically.
Okay, well, Sierra Tucson is, the view is that we deal, again, holistically like you do, Stuart, with the whole person, biological, psychological, and spiritual. And Sierra Tucson's philosophy is bottom line, it is a 12-step based treatment center. And so the 12 steps are a big piece of what we teach and a big piece of the program. And in terms of, it's not a religious thing. It is absolutely about finding a power greater than yourself. And one of the things that I find myself saying to the patients often, and family members who I work with who come there for family program, is that the power greater than self can be the group.
Mm-hmm.
And for you to have an opportunity to experience support from other people who know what you're going through, who know how you feel, who have been through similar situations. And that also is one of the greatest gifts of 12-step, is that, you know, you're with people who you don't even have to explain it to. They know.
Right.
And so when people come in, that is a, you know, I don't like to get into the whole religious thing. You know, there's no reason to get into a power struggle about that. It's about, okay, you've been trying to do this on your own. How well has it been working?
Mm-hmm.
So you have a right. You have a right to ask for help. You have a right to get help. You have a right to have support. And so that's my piece about that.
And the 12-step programs even say higher power as you define it.
Absolutely.
And to me, that could be defined as love. It could be defined as intuition. It could be defined as the word God.
Right.
However, or like you said, the group support,
right.
the group energy, because for some people, religion is the source of the trauma as a kid.
Exactly.
You know, whether I have a friend who is, you know, molested by a priest in part of one of the settlements, you know,
right.
in Kentucky about this, but it's also religion in terms of, like, you know, I'm a gay man, and there are a lot of gay people who are so traumatized by the judgments of their own religion.
Absolutely.
You know, so there's a lot of
absolutely
traumatizing that went on in the name of religion, and yet there are many people, when they do their healing, actually have a more peaceful connection with their base religion, with the religion they were raised in. Once
very much, and I've seen people go back to, a sponsee of mine actually was away from her church for a long time, and when she got sober, she went back and said that she feels a connection that she didn't feel prior. I've done some of the same in terms of being raised Jewish, and one of the concerns for people who are not Christian is that this is a Christian organization. I know that there's fear in the Jewish community that this is more like a Christian cult.
Right.
And, you know, so there was an organization started back in New York called JAX, which is Jewish Alcoholics and Chemically Dependent Significant Others, so that so Jewish people could feel like we could use the, you know, the 12 steps. But
from a more Talmudic point of view.
Or exactly,
okay.
Yeah. And
well, you know, whatever works.
So they didn't have to go into a church basement, Stuart, so they
right.
could go into a synagogue, you know.
Yeah.
But in terms of, again, in terms of treatment and recovery process, Sierra Tucson does not only deal with, you know, if somebody comes in with alcohol abuse or alcoholism, and they're dependent, they are in a program where people in their group are also dealing with that and or other substances, chemicals, and part of the work as well is focused on family of origin and taking a look at issues that we talked about in the first half hour, What may be contributing to? So now that you're not drinking, yes, we're going to work on how do you not drink one day at a time, and what other issues may be present. And that's one of the reasons why the family program is the crux of Sierra Tucson, because we really believe that this is addiction is a family disease. Everybody is impacted by it.
Mm-hmm.
And for the 15 or so years that I've been doing this work, every family I've ever worked with, everybody is impacted in some way, shape, or form, whether they are addicted to a substance themselves, they grew up in an alcoholic or addicted kind of family, they've had their own traumas, and like you said earlier, it gets passed down. Somebody's going to act it out, and they act it out in addiction or compulsion. So we address trauma issues. There's a specific trauma program that people come in, and they have been, they have relapsed many times, and we assess that it's because of unresolved trauma. And so when they go into the trauma program, that's the focus, and they're also getting addiction treatment. There's a new program that opened, I believe, about a year and a half or 2 years ago at Sierra Tucson. It's called the Mood Disorder Program, and that's for people who mainly are dealing with depression, anxiety disorders, and or bipolar disorder, which we used to call manic depressive
right.
or manic depression. And so people are coming in to deal with that. Some of them have substance or other addictions. Some of them don't. Most people do. They have some kind of addictive behavior. If it's not to alcohol or other drugs, it's a lot, shopping, spending, compulsive
eating.
Gambling, food, eating disorders, either compulsive eating, anorexia, or bulimia. And Sierra Tucson is really special in that it has the staff, the training, the ability to, and the focus that we deal with everything.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't deal with one piece of the person. And so I feel very privileged to be able to work in that model and to work there amongst, such highly qualified clinicians and doctors and nursing staff. And it's really a very, very special place, and people get incredible treatment there. And, again, holistically, there is we also have what we call the TRAP program, which is therapeutic recreational activities, where there's a climbing wall and there is equine-assisted psychotherapy, and we have a pool where they do water aerobics, and so an
exercise. You deal with horses and equine therapy too, I understand.
I'm sorry?
Is there also an equine program? Like
there is, yes, equine-assisted psychotherapy. So we have horses that specifically are trained to be used for therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And so equine therapy doesn't mean you're going to go ride a horse. We have horseback riding, but the horses are incredible therapeutic tools. And
right.
In the mood disorder and the trauma program, they're utilized once a week for that. People coming in for chemical dependency specifically, I believe they get it once or twice while they're there for a month. But in terms of the mood disorder and the trauma program, there's some more experiential therapies built in due to the nature of the issues that people are dealing with. And, people are just blown away by the equine, and people are blown away by the climbing wall and some other of the adventure therapies that they do, because it's not sit-down talk therapy. And
mm-hmm.
a lot of times that doesn't work when you have cellular memory.
Right. Right.
It's not cutting it. And so that's Sierra Tucson. There's a lot of experiential modalities. We do EMDR. We have 4 EMDR therapists. We do something called somatic experiencing, which Peter Levine started, and that is it's coming to be known more in the community now, and very powerful for patients. Again, not a lot of words. It's about reprogramming your neurology, your patterns of movement to release trauma.
We go any further, I want to acknowledge Sierra Tucson for the diversity of clients that they accept, and that there is a wide range ethnically and racially, and also that it's a very GLBT-friendly environment.
It absolutely is. Barbara Mountner is our GLBT specialist, and she's fabulous, and we're very, very supportive of GLBT issues and taking a look at those in terms of how do they impact recovery. And I specifically was working with a family several weeks ago where this was an issue with an adult son, and worked with the family because there was religious differences there. They were very, very, very religious based, the parents were, and they, we love you, and we don't approve of your lifestyle, and we will accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was tough work for everybody, and I believe they came through with an acceptance that they could disagree about that,
mm-hmm.
and they could still love each other.
And that's the beginning, actually, of what for some families is a long road to acceptance,
yeah.
and understanding. So at least if you can get to that point, very often I've seen years down the road, all of a sudden it become a non-issue in those families.
Right. Yeah.
Now, let's talk about your own work. I know you do workshops in the community and you're available for public speaking. What kind of things do you are you out there actually doing in the community, separate from Sierra Tucson?
Yes, I am on the advisory board for the Jewish Federation, Jewish Family and Children's Services here in Tucson, and it's called JAS, and it is the Jewish Advisory Board for Substance Abuse Services.
Mm-hmm.
And I will be doing, in October, I will be doing an encore presentation, a part two of Women in Addiction, and how do we seek treatment, and what services are available, and what if you love somebody who's addicted, what do you do? And so that's a luncheon. Doing that, and I'm involved with that, really trying to get education out to the Jewish community about addictions and trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, through JFCS, they do a continuing education program for professionals here in Tucson, and I'll be presenting on, in general, women and addiction through the life cycle, what issues the professionals need to be aware of and what issues do women go through in young adulthood, middle adulthood, and late adulthood, and what things to look for and deal with. And the other piece that I'm doing this fall is I will be a presenter at a conference called the Summit for Clinical Excellence, which Sierra Tucson is one of the sponsors of. It's through the Ben Franklin Institute, and it's happening in Scottsdale the first weekend of November. And I'll be presenting one of the breakout sessions on forgiveness for trauma and addictions. And I have my own concept and ideas about forgiveness, and some of them are very different than other people's and other models out there. So I'll be presenting that for people just, again, to chew on and see what they think.
Now, is this conference open to the general public or just the professionals?
That's a great question. I believe it's just for professionals, but I'm not sure, and I would encourage people to go to the website. It's the Ben Franklin Institute.
Now, also, you have a website, and I know that if people really like what they're hearing from you, that they could actually get some audio tapes and videotapes of some of your workshops and audio presentations, and that your website is your name, basically, www.adinabanklees. That's A, D as in David, E-N-A, Bank as in bank teller, Lees, LEES.com, AdinaBankLees.com, and you can get more information about Adina and her work. You can order some of her tapes and practical materials. She has a manual here, and you can also email her via that website. People who are listening can also get more information about Sierra Tucson by going to their website, which is SierraTucson.com, SierraTucson, one word. And if you forget all that and you are still wanting to either get in touch with me or Sierra Tucson or Adina Bank Lees, you can go to the website for TellTheTruthFaster.com. You could email me or Adina, and I'll make sure it gets passed on to her. You can also send people there in about a week, where this show will be archived along with the last 2 years of my shows, so you can listen to this or any other show that I've done for the last 2 years, which basically has been a lot of shows on addictions, on treatment issues, on depression, on anxiety, on GLBT issues, and all of the above. And I always welcome your emails, your comments, your questions, your disagreements, your agreements. you know, whatever. So those are ways to reach Adina, CR Tucson, and myself. We only have a couple of minutes left, Adina. Is there any parting words or anything else you want to make sure everybody knows or...
I think so. Yes, Stuart, thank you. One other thing I want to add is that I do have a private practice. And so if anybody's interested, and I also do clinical supervision, I do it in face-to-face or I do it over the phone.
Your practice is in Tucson?
It is in Tucson,
okay.
Yes.
That's important that people know that.
And I only see adults.
Okay.
I don't see teenagers or children at this time. And so you can absolutely go to the website and contact me through there. And the other thing I want to say is that thriving is absolutely possible, and it does take work, and it does take time, and it is a process, and that you have a right not to be a victim anymore, that you have a right to be a survivor, and you have a right to even go from survivor to thriver. And the way to do that is, my belief is, the combination of the 12-step program and a therapist who supports a 12-step program, who works in a way that Stuart was describing, holistically and appreciatingly about your experience as a human being.
And to remind people also, which I think is very important, because most people who need it fear the idea of actually going inpatient for treatment, like at a place like Sierra Tucson. And there are places like Sierra Tucson all over the country that are high quality, that are sane places where you're getting some really effective treatment by people who have years and years of experience in this. And, you know, usually most people go for about 30 days, some longer, some shorter, but it's time extremely well spent because it gets you out of your current environment that's part of the insanity that you're going through, creates a sense of safety, and actually helps you plan for re-emerging into whatever environment you need to go back to and have that type of safety. So, Adina, we need to stop here. I really, really want to thank you for taking the time on this Saturday to be on the show and for contributing some really insightful and intelligent information to me and my listeners. So thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Stuart. It's a pleasure.
Okay, so this is Stuart Altshuler on Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM 1310 in Phoenix. Thanking you for listening and asking you to tune in again next week at the same time, and we'll be back with Tell the Truth Faster. Have a good afternoon and a great weekend.